Fred and Jeff and John are the three horsemen. They never get along, they're the three horsemen. They argue about science fiction and fantasy. Fred and Jeff and John are the three horsemen. Ride, horsemen, ride.
Hi, this is Jeff Patterson, and it is the month of March. February is gone. It is in the books, and we're writing it off as a loss. It is March, and it is once again time for another episode of The Three Horsemen. We have no guests this month. We are just scrambling to keep up with everything that life throws at us. I am joined, as always, by my two co-hosts. Say hello, Mr. John Stevens.
Stupid life. I have been waylaid with an infection for a couple of weeks, so my life has not been terribly awesome, but I am here and I'm very eager to talk about tonight's stuff. I am on Twitter as Erudite Ogre. I write for SF Signal some, haven't done it for a while, but I'm getting back to it, and I write other stuff too in various places.
Awesome. Mr. Fred Kish, say hi.
Howdy. This is Fred Kish. I am Fred Kish on Twitter. And I'm on all the other 60 million social media platforms. And you generally can't find me on SF Signal unless I'm reading very, very old blog posts.
Yeah, I actually had to play catch up with your blog a couple days ago.
No, I took a stroll through memory lane to see way, way back in SF Signal's history, when was the first time I commented? And noticed certain very familiar names that are still around.
Yeah.
And then I had to go through the whole Blade Runner duo. And then I had to go through the God Whale controversy.
Oh, God. I remember that.
So it was an amusing week of strolling through the archives.
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah, I too was following you along on that and reading all that old stuff. And I was like, oh, my God, SF Signal podcast episode 34. Oh, that was so long ago.
Yep.
So I'm Jeff Patterson, Jeff Patterson 11 on Twitter. I blog at Gravity Lens, which can be found at Bad Day Studio. And I currently have some prints for sale on the Hops Gallery, the Hops Gallery online store that they have put together. I'll put a link to that in there somewhere. They have been very nice. Unfortunately, they haven't been open here in town because of all the fun weather that we've been having. And I, too, have been battling a small series of illnesses, but figure let's get us together while we can. So we are going to be talking about a couple things. We're going to be talking about Thomas Dish a little bit tonight. But first, we would be remiss if we did not talk about Leonard Nimoy a tiny bit with his passing a couple days ago at the time of this recording. The possibly one of the five or six characters who represented the genre character-wise, fictional character-wise, as opposed to like somebody behind the scenes or a director or famous author, and who at the time, I mean, I didn't really get into Star Trek till I was probably 8 or 9 years old, so it was past the first run, but as soon as I got into Star Trek fandom in the early 70s, it was obvious the impact that Spock has had, and the fact that what we've seen in the last few days with everybody linking to every old interview and every old commercial and cereal box and stuff like that, we realize what a icon the character was at the time. I got to get a photograph autographed by him back in 78 at Star Trek Expo down in New York City, back when you could go to a Star Trek convention and just about the entire cast would be there, as well as about 20 guest stars, as opposed to these days where you might get one cast member and a guy who wore a Gurn suit for a commercial or something. but it was Star Trek Expo. You got everybody there, and Angelique Pettyjohn was there, and a ton of guest stars and directors and other authors. And I remember Leonard Nimoy said something to Isaac Asimov at one point because they had both just gotten a chance to see the pilot, the two-hour pilot movie for Battlestar Galactica. And they were both in agreement that if you wanted to watch Star Wars again, but were sick of watching Star Wars, you should watch Battlestar Galactica. So, was what it came down to. Fandom wise, the first real example of the other on television that was done non-ironically. You know, Lord knows we had My Favorite Martian and the witches and the genies from the sitcoms, and we had various, Mr. Ed and My Mother the Car, and we had all these, characters that were outside human experience that were done for either ironic or comedic value. And there's nothing wrong with that. But Spock was probably aside from certain aliens in Twilight Zone and Out of Limits and stuff like that, Spock was the first long-running character that was designed to take us out of ourselves. I think his first line in Where No Man Has Gone Before is, "Ah, yes, one of your Earth emotions." And, obviously the importance that he had on the genre, and the fact, what really surprised me this past week was just how many of the younger people in fandom were the ones who were the most vocal about how much the death meant.
Well, there's hope for those kids yet.
Yeah, there is.
Yeah, there was. I was actually really, I suppose I shouldn't have been surprised, but I was quite surprised by the breadth of responses. Like, you expect, within science fiction circles, TV and all that, a lot of people responding, because up until, very recently, he was still acting and he was still taking photographs, doing other stuff, too. But what was interesting to me was just the, like, all across, all the vectors of entertainment and media and, well, outside of strict SF fandom. There was a huge, huge upswelling of like very emotional responses, which I thought was quite nice. It was interesting to me because I heard about it because someone called the bookstore and said, "Did you just hear? Leonard Nimoy died." And I cannot remember the last time someone actually called the bookstore and to say so and so just died. Not even authors. So it was considered a huge deal. The interesting thing to me personally was that, and this will sort of dovetail with probably why I like Dish so much, I sort of see death as inevitable and everyone's going to die and it's sad when it happens, but I don't feel very much when someone says, "Oh, such and such a celebrity died." The interesting thing to me about this one was that I actually did feel something, and I was surprised that I was sad. Like, Leonard Nimoy died. That really sucks. And it got me thinking not just about his role as Spock, but I've always kind of admired Nimoy because he's always seemed very consistently to be very dignified and reflective and thoughtful in a way that you don't often see in celebrities. He was really, I thought, an atypical kind of celebrity in that regard. He was very artistic and he was very meticulous and thoughtful in ways that, like I said, I don't see in a lot of other celebrities, and I really admired him for the way he conducted his life, not just the roles he played and the things that he made, but just the way that he lived his life. I admired very greatly. Yeah,
there's a sequence in the movie Trekkies, the documentary Trekkies, where he talks about
that's right.
It, after the show was done and they started seeing the fandom swelling and it dawning on him that they were now encountering a force. It was unshaped and it had no direction, but it certainly had traction.
Right.
One of the things he says is something to the effect of whether or not it was going to be a force for good was going to be up to was going to be up to basically everybody who was part of it. And that was one of the reasons why, you know, a lot of the people who were involved in the show did get involved heavily with fandom afterwards. And when you think about it, that was probably the first cultural phenomenon. I mean, you think back to, you know, Elvis, the Beatles, Sinatra, anyone, Dolly, anyone who was that big and that popular at the time, there was no venue or outlet for interacting with them. There were no Elvis conventions. There were no, you know, Hemingway conventions or anything like that. And the fact that, that fandom as a force pretty much got its start directly in the wake of Star Trek and the years following when it went into syndication, to a level that definitely stepped it up from where fandom had existed before that. It's just, very intriguing to me the way the whole thing played out. The other thing that I did get a chuckle out was how many venues and papers and publications who had spent years and years, you know, decrying the existence of Star Trek science fiction and fandom in general wrote such glowing appreciations of them too. That is always one of those, do we have to forgive them? Yes, we have to, but we don't have to be happy about it. So, Fred, what about you?
Well, he was, I mean, I remember him actually in things like Twilight Zone on the first run, because I came to the shocking realization that, yes, I did see Twilight Zone and Outer Limits on their first runs, part of them. But, him, his character, Bones McCoy, and Scotty were like the three reflections or consciences of the main character, namely Kirk. You know, Spock was the logical and thinking one. McCoy was the emotional one. Scotty was the practical one. And it's a shame that all three have left us at this point. I enjoyed him in Mission Impossible.
Loved him in Mission Impossible.
I mean, you know, it's amazing, you know, starting with Zombies of the Stratosphere, them, Twilight Zone. Can't remember whether he was in Outer Limits or not.
He did. He's in the
Purple Twilight, maybe?
Ooh, he might be. I'll have to look that up.
Well, okay, Outer Limits, Twilight Zone, and then, you know, Star Trek, Mission Impossible, you know, and the movies, even Fringe, for crying out loud.
Yeah. He's in the Donald Sutherland Body Snatchers, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
That too. Yeah. You know, so he was definitely an actor who would take on any role that he was given. And then, of course, there's always, who can forget Bilbo Baggins? I mean, it's hilarious to think, you know, that something that people made fun of him about, he later embraced, and if you've seen that one commercial with Zachary Quinto.
Yeah.
Where they're the car commercial.
Yeah.
And there's Nimoy driving along singing the Ballad of Bilbo Baggins.
Yeah. I got a kick out of, I was talking with somebody about early Trek fiction, and I kept saying, you know, you do realize that the first two original novels were both about Spock, and Spock Messiah and Spock Must Die. And
you know that those are actually the second and third, not the original two.
What was the first one?
Was a book called Mission to Horatius by Mac Reynolds, which came out like 4 years before Spock Must Die.
I have to look that up. Okay.
It was a YA novel.
Ah.
So was not part of the Bantam series.
Wow. It instills a degree of stoicism in me when things like this happen, you know, because you realize, yeah, this awaits us all. But even when you have a little bit of warning, it certainly manages to break one's heart. But it has been nice to see the outpouring that has been there. So, not to start on a downer note, our plan for the February episode had all along been to discuss the works of Thomas Dish, which had been originated by me because of my love of the book 334. And as life gets in the way, our rereads kind of went one way or another, and I ended up reading a bunch of other stuff that I wasn't planning on, and so my original focus for the discussion kind of fell apart very early on in the process. But we did want to talk about Thomas Dish, and it's the timing is funny because, unbeknownst to me, Scott Edelman put up an interview that he did with Dish in 84 for the winter 1986 issue of Last Wave magazine. And it is a massive interview. It's over 18,000 words. And it just went up, and I vaguely remember this interview when it was published, and I'm halfway through the reread as we record this right now. I thought it was funny because I'm remembering a lot of my experiences with Dish in the 80s. He used to give a lot of interviews back then, which is something I had also forgotten about. But I originally had wanted to talk about 334, and I did a reread of 334, and something very odd happened during the reread of it. And I have to go back and tell a personal story on this one, because when I first read 334, I came to the conclusion that the Fire Sign Theater album, Don't Crush That Dwarf, Hand Me the Pliers, was based on this book. I read the book well after I had heard that album, and I knew that album by heart at the time, and found out shortly thereafter that the book actually came out well over a year before that album came out. But there were just so many parallels in my mind. This has got to be maybe 83. I make this conclusion as only 20-year-old me can do. And I thought I was so bright, and I thought it brought such insight to both the book and the album and stuff like that. So I probably reread it again in the early 90s, and I hadn't reread it since then. So I reread it, and I'm saying, what the hell was I thinking? I'm not seeing anything that could possibly make me think that, you know, yes, there's discussion of aging, and there's talk about how the media impacts you, and there's artifice, everything around you is artifice, and yes, there's sort of a very droll and dry sense of humor that runs through the whole thing.
And they both have pliers in them.
Yes, it does. But it was such a weird thing. You know, I picked it back up, and I start reading, and I sat there with a little pad next to me going, okay, let's check everything off that plucks at that neuron as I go through it. And no, didn't see it this time around. So it's one of those points where I wish I had a time machine where I can go back and talk to my younger self and go, what, how good were the drugs at this point that made me draw patterns where none existed? Regardless, there were a couple things about 334 that I had totally forgotten about. I had forgotten just how utterly vignette driven it was. Also, I mentioned artifice. I forgot what a big role that plays over the course of the book. The whole idea of a supermarket as a museum, so you can go see what supermarkets used to be like and stuff like that. And it's funny because my wife is a big fan of the stop animation show The PJs, which was the big Eddie Murphy production, which takes place in a very, very large apartment building, and all the various oddball characters that live there. And as I was doing this reread, she was actually watching some episodes of the PJs as they were playing. And I at a couple points there would be like a similar line or a similar scenario that would sort of play out on both the book and the show. And I started realizing, wow, there's a lot of I forgot just how much urban experience he was trying to play over the course of this book, which was something I had totally forgotten about at the time. But I do still like it. I do still like it. I'm not going to say it's aged particularly well, but I think certainly a lot of the arcs and the themes that are in it certainly have. John,
sure.
As Dish goes, was 334 one of your favorites, or?
Well, it's interesting when you talk about, you know, encountering the book, I read On Wings of Song. It was my first exposure to Dish. And I was really put off when I started to read On Wings of Song. But then as I went through it, I actually wrote something about Oppressive Sigma a couple years ago. But as I got into it, it just sort of opened up all these sort of doorways in terms of literature and thinking about things. And then when I went to 334, which is different in a lot of ways from On Wings of Song, I felt weirdly put off at first. Because while I was already sort of, you know, I sort of knew going in that it would be a very dystopian world, that there would be a lot of sort of weird moments of irony, an occasional flash of humor maybe, and just this, you know, I sort of knew going in what sort of the tone would be, but I think I wasn't prepared for the sort of fine-grained close view of life that it presented, which is kind of what On Wings of Song does, but does it in a different way. So I actually had to read 334 twice before I think I really started to appreciate it. And, you know, one of the things that, you know, about a Dish book is that you can go back to it time and time again and get new stuff out of it every time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's particularly true of 334, probably because of the structure that he uses and the way that the vignettes sort of pile up in terms of feelings and ideas about what's going on in the world around the characters. So On Wings of Song is still my favorite Dish book, partly for personal reasons and partly just because I think it's actually in some ways the best thing he wrote. But 334 is really, really good book. I mean, it's definitely for me a close second.
I think I read Genocides first, actually.
Yeah, I didn't read Genocides till much later.
I think I did read that first. I think I still have the actual issue I bought in the 70s.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, Algis Budrys hated the Genocides.
Yeah.
he wrote a
lot
ripping,
of people did.
A lot of people did, but he wrote a particularly ripping review of it. I was reading David Seed's A Companion to Science Fiction last week, and I found that little nugget in there about, you know, how much, well, Budrys had to admit that in some ways it was a well-done book. He just totally tore into it in terms of how it went against the science fiction that he liked, basically. Which is, you know, not a surprise because that was a large part of Dish's career, was he really wanted to go against the grain in a lot of ways, against the prevailing the prevailing science fiction of the era.
Genocides did bum me out. I remember that. I remember there's a few books in a row that I read that really bummed me out. I think that was one of them. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Genocides is totally is really designed to bum you out, really. Yeah. but you know that's the great thing about Dish to me is that while he doesn't write very cheerful or happy books, and this is something I thought about as I was rereading 334, he does actually do something that I hadn't seen before, which is, despite the often overwhelmingly dystopian and terrible circumstances the characters sometimes find themselves in, they always seem to have a fair amount of agency in the world. Like, they can make choices. They can do things, and they can do surprising things. And even if those things are going to fail, and they know they're going to fail, they still have the option to do them and at least make the attempt. Like, so much of Dish's writing is about characters making the attempt to do something that will break them out of whatever bind they're in, whatever situation they're facing. And even if it doesn't work, there's a sense that, you know, even though, you know, you may not succeed, and even though you know that, you know, to get sort of a broader view of Dish, you know, the idea of death and the end of things is a big aspect of his writing. Even though we all know we're going to die, we keep trying anyway.
Yeah.
even though we know the aliens are going to exterminate us, we fight back anyway. Even though, you know, in the case of One Wings of Song, you know, Daniel is not a very good artist, but he, in some form or another, you know, achieves his escape at the end of the book. And, I mean, you hear a lot about Dish as sort of being pessimistic and ironic and bitter, and his stuff's all about death and how bad things are. But when you actually read it and think about what the characters are doing, they have an incredible amount of agency, despite the structurally constrained positions they're often put in by the situations that surround them in their reality.
You know, it's funny that you say that, because I was thinking about he used to do the book column in Twilight Zone magazine. But I remember in his book reviews, the only other person I can compare it to, and I really don't even want to make the comparison, was I remember when Norman Spinrad used to do those long reviews, you know, where he would cover like three or four books at a time and it would turn into this very long essay that you really didn't know where it was going. Mm-hmm. And then finally he would come around to talking about the books that he was doing. Dish didn't take the similar tack, but he certainly created themes around the books that he was writing. And I remember that he would talk about, you know, his, not only his take of the book, but also his experience in the reading of the book. Mm-hmm. And he also criticized books, both in the positive and the negative, for the agency of characters. That was something that he really sort of hammered home. And I've noticed some of the reviews I've read that Paul DeFilippo has done. He does the same thing. He sort of takes the same approach where, and okay, yes, the world building is groovy, and yes, the technology is fun and the plot is fun, but how involved in this story is this character? And that was something that he took a lot of writers to task for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that totally makes sense.
Fred, I got the impression that you did Catching Up on this. Were you a Dish fan at all?
My experience with Dish was, I'm sure I've read some of his short stories, but I'm not sure about any novels, and I didn't read 334. I did read Camp Concentration this time, and I read two sets of nonfiction, keeping with my plan this year to try and read mostly nonfiction. So before I get to my stuff, I was wondering, was 334 a novel from the start, or was it a fix-up?
That's a good question.
Because remember, Delaney did his book, The American Shore, based on just one part of this, which I presume was published separately, which is why, you know, he just concentrated on the one section. Oh, let me look it up. Unless you remember, John. Angoulême, The American Shore: Meditations on a Tale of Science Fiction by Thomas M. Dish -Angoulême, which, if I remember correctly, is about one third or 50% of the way into 334. So that kind of gives me the impression that this was originally published separately. But I'm not sure.
I'm trying to remember, because part of the thing with 234 is that it is a composite structure.
Yeah.
But it was also conceived, I mean, as a novel.
Right.
My understanding is, so I don't remember if some of it was published in snippets beforehand.
Well, we'll have to dig that up, because I was wondering, like, if it came out and, you know, maybe I could see part of it appearing in Damon Knight's Orbit, you know, things like that, that published, right. Well, you know, that's the place you'd find off the track stuff.
Right.
Or even in Ellison, Dangerous Visions, maybe. I'm not sure. We'll have to look that up. So what I did read was Camp Concentration, which reminded me strongly of, like, being a Thomas Pynchon kind of novel.
Mm-hmm.
Where you've got a political prisoner in a very, very strange prison camp where you're not sure who's running the place, the inmates or the guards. And I enjoyed most of it, except right at the beginning, I'm like, I mean, part of what they're doing in the book for, you know, to spoil a 30-odd-year-old book, is that the prisoners are injected with a variant of a sexually transmitted disease, and that enhances their intelligence before they eventually die. Is that a good summary of
yep.
you know, the program?
Yep, that's...
But the problem is you don't know if any of the things that the prisoners are doing is actually... Are they really getting more intelligent, or is this just a lot of nonsense?
I see what you're saying there. I do remember having a very similar, given the number of books that science fiction has produced regarding advanced intellect, there have been examples where it's been much more convincing than camp concentration, yep. let's put it that way, and I think that might have spoiled us.
You even get to the point where that there's a deus ex machina at the end. And I'm like, well, did this really happen, or is this guy so sick that he's just hallucinating what has happened? And it's, you know, like Terry Gilliam's Brazil, where you've got the two endings, depending on which version of the movie you see.
Right.
Does the guy get rescued, or does he not get rescued? So, you know, it was a short read. I enjoyed it. It's a hilarious book in parts. Definitely if you like Pynchon or William S. Burroughs, I think you'd like this. And then the other two that I read was the one I believe he won the Hugo for, which is The Dreams Our Stuff Is Made Of, How Science Fiction Conquered the World. And then kind of like a predecessor or a precursor book to that on SF, which is a series of essays. Mm-hmm. And this is probably the reason why I didn't get the 334, is that both these books have frustrated me incredibly for a number of reasons. You know, partly every now and then I'm like, well, why aren't you looking at these 20 years worth of stuff when you go from point A to point B? Or I, you know, see bad, what I think is bad research, or just ignoring stuff in order to make a point. Or just jumping around and adding in a lot of stuff that really has nothing to do with what he's talking about. Like, he seems to be in love with UFO people and millennial cults. And, I mean, it's just like, you know, I don't know. I don't think there's quite as bold a connection between these things you're saying, sir. I'm sorry. So.
Yeah, I can.
I would pick up both these books. I would start reading them that night when I was done with everything else. I would get a few pages in. I would toss them across the room and put them down and not get the 334, which I will read eventually this year. And I will read the Delaney book as well this year. But I was just, I don't know. No traction.
No, I get that completely. I get that. I get that.
Well, have either of you read those two or not?
I have not read
them.
Okay.
Sorry.
No, I have not, John.
No, I've read them. I mean, and I've read quite a lot of Dish. And it's... to me, there's a difference between writing a book where you're trying to be prescriptive and a book where you're trying to be polemical. And both of those are polemical. They're not attempts to analyze science fiction's components or the nuances of the genre. They're Dish conducting kind of mean thought experiments. That's the best way to put it.
Well, yeah, the mean part I'll agree with.
Well, then, you know, but that's, you know, Dish was very, for a while, was very conflicted about science fiction. And then he wrote a lot of really good science fiction that got very little attention. I mean, he won only a couple of awards in his life. The On Wings of Song won the Campbell, and I think he won the Hugo for one of the other books, right? Did you say Freddie won for one of the nonfiction books?
Well, he won for this the stuff the dreams are made of. Yes,
right. The stuff our dreams are made of. So he didn't get a lot of appreciation, and you know. He wanted to provoke, but at the same time, he wanted to be appreciated. I mean, it's like a lot of his protagonists are smart, artistic people who are doing their art and want to both tell people something and be appreciated. And part of what you see in the two those two books is his frustration with people not understanding some of the implications of how science fiction is produced and read.
Well, I'm amused by the fact that on the back of the Dreams Our Stuff Is Made Of, mm-hmm. is this wonderful quote from Robert Silverberg from the Wall Street Journal. Mr. Dish's lively and provocative new book is a science fiction insider's brilliant attempt to come to terms with the bizarre morphing of our civilization in the past 50 years into something that might well have leaped out of the archetypical tales of yesterday's SF masters. And of course, I'm not sure how many times Dish like slams Silverberg for various things in the book. I'm like, Bob, did you read the book? The guy doesn't like it. I don't know. I mean, there's several people that have been through this route. I mean, Ellison hates SF, but I don't think he could survive without it, and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. But it just seemed very sketchy to me in places, and just so mean, as you put it.
Right. Well, but and like I said, there's a level at which both of those books are sort of mean thought experiments. Mm-hmm. But the emphasis is more on the thought experiment than the meanness. Like, the meanness is just sort of the position he's coming from to try to unpack some things that he thinks are interesting. I mean, on SF, I think it's where he talks about SF as sort of being akin to children's literature in some ways. And he says a little later on in the book, it's not that I'm saying it is children's literature. I'm saying that there are some commonalities between the two things that I see. And it's interesting to me that that's there. Yep. So it's not like, his criticism on formal poetry structure or criticism of poetry, which took a much different tack than his criticism of SF. Because for him, SF isn't like poetry. It's not a genre of communication. It's this odd little, genre sort of mode that people engage in to tell stories. And he's interested in trying to figure out, in a sense, what bothers him about it, and trying to communicate that to other people, and trying to get them to see from his position what it looks like.
Right.
So, and I think that's different than a book of criticism that tries to say, do something like what Darko Suvin did with a much more formalist, Marxist approach, or even what Delany does with his combination of, Barth and a little bit of structuralism, to try to take SF apart. And, and as with a lot of things with Dish and SF, there's an oddly personal anchorage there.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I've read a little bit of his poetry criticism, and I read some of his poems, and the sort of, bitterness that you sometimes feel is not anywhere near as present in his criticism or in his poetry. SF really bugged him. Because he used it. He used some of the conventions and subverted a lot of conventions and produced what we could recognizably call science fiction, but it never really got acknowledged. I don't know if it really did what he had hoped it would do artistically in the literary field.
Well, you could say that about all of New Age.
Yeah, I was about to say, you could say that about a lot of people in SF, so...
You could, but Ballard, Dick, a lot of other New Wave, even Delany, are sort of much more appreciated, much more a part of the history of SF and acknowledged as part of the history of SF in ways that Dish is not. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was really funny to me reading some more contemporary criticism from the 70s and 80s and articles about the New Wave. And Dish is like right in there with everybody else. And like when they list off, the half dozen best New Wave writers, but he never made it out of that era, essentially.
Yeah, other than the
Brave Little Toaster. Whereas everyone else did. Right, but that's right. So for a surreal children's book is what he ends up getting known for.
Yep.
And not for this relatively large body, if you look at his bibliography, of SF that he wrote, there was even when it was maybe bitter and derogatory, was still very well done. He was a very good writer.
Yes.
I mean, stylistically and with his structuration, it's just, you know, he's unquestionably a very talented writer.
I mean, that I appreciate the books. They just irritated me, which is good because you should read things that irritate you.
Exactly.
On the other hand, I have to think, I'm not as familiar with fandom in other genres, but do mystery writers hate the field as much as science fiction writers do at time, or romance writers, or cowboy writers? I mean, it just seems that we seem to have this need at times. You know?
I find that to be kind of a cultural thing. Because in terms of an actual subculture formed around science fiction and fantasy in a way that it didn't around a lot of other genres.
Right.
There's definitely a romance subculture, but it's still not the same. Like, romance readers I don't think take the same kind of weird pride that science fiction readers take in being able to read science fiction and decode it and feel the sense of superiority to other readers. Like in other genres that have, you know, mystery fans or romance fans or Western fans, there isn't a lot of the cultural stuff that gets accrued to science fiction fans.
Mm. That's
very different.
Yeah, that's a multi-hour discussion because I've always kind of poked fun at the sort of self-induced irony that a lot of mystery fans, especially the traditional mystery fan who is reading mystery for escapism as opposed to the police procedural or the very dramatic detective story and stuff like that. When you had a lot of mid-list detective stories that were coming out in chains, and when you had, you know, you had all the Agatha Christie characters and you had all the mystery shows that were working with beloved characters. And I remember there was an ad for some dinner murder cruise or something like that, you know, where you got on a train and there was a murder mystery and you could buy tickets. And the opening line of the commercial was, "It's a wonderful night for murder." And I was like, advertising a murder mystery train thing is the only scenario where that sentence is acceptable. Okay. You cannot, you know, there's a degree of a lighthearted approach. I don't want to say they're fetishizing murder, but there's definitely a lighthearted approach to it. And I think that a lot of that, which I'm calling the traditional mystery fan base, I'm certain they may have their own nomenclature for the types and stripes, et cetera. But, you know, as time passed and mysteries became more and more or less ironic and less lighthearted and less escapism and more heavily entrenched in the reality of the day, you know, they became the Image Comics of murder mysteries, basically. That kind of sort of went away, and I'm wondering if, yes, perhaps maybe there is a degree of contempt inside the fandom, you know, for lack of a better phrase, similar to what we've seen in SF, like you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
But that's just me. I want to talk about The Prisoner briefly, but I'm kind of curious, John, about I've never read any of his poetry. What is he handling for subject matter and stuff like that?
It varies. I mean, some of them are very personal poems, like in Dark Versus Light, there's a poem about, you know, being fat. But then he writes these really long, sort of dramatic fables too. I mean, what the heck's it called? Let me hang on a second. Like the Snake in the Manger, the Christmas legend, which is one of the early first poems in Dark Versus in Light. It's this really long, and it's basically like a little epic, a little saga. But then he'll switch off to stuff that reads more like drama, that has, you know, character parts going back and forth. And then his poetry is pretty variegated. And you can see some, you know, sort of SF fantasy aspects to it. But then you switch, like I said, to poems that talk about, you know, a sense of going home, or it means sort of much more, we think of a sort of typical quote-unquote, you know, poetic themes. And what's interesting is the variety there, and it's so different in a lot of ways than his SF fiction. And yet at the same time, the humor is sometimes there, the irony is there, and some of that feeling of you know, I don't like to call it bitterness, because that, I think, comes for me too much, you know, seeing him at the end of his life and when he was on LiveJournal doing poems and talking very openly about feeling depressed. But there's definitely that sort of that gritty feeling of, you know, that carries through, I think, almost all of his work, of, you know, the fact, again, that, you know, life has one outcome. Life has one outcome. We're all going to have the same outcome to life. And the question is, what can we do with the world that is around us, not to stave that off, but to do the things we want to do and to create the things we want to create before it happens? And I think some of that comes out in his poetry too. Mm-hmm. But like I said, it's definitely more variegated in terms of theme and form than even you see in his SF fiction.
Huh. I'm going to have to check some of that out. I did want to talk about The Prisoner a little bit, though, for a couple different reasons. And that is, I did a little bit of research, and I found very little actual critical reaction to that book. And I cannot recall any that I had encountered. And it's certainly a... let's put it this way, when it comes to Prisoner fandom, talk about a rabid bunch, it's something that really doesn't get brought up all that much. And it's sort of almost like the little forgotten adaptation that exists inside of SF.
Well, it was hard to find for a long time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the copy I got in the late 70s was something like Target Books. Yeah, so an import.
Like, I remember reading it and saying, and reading it fairly young too, and kind of thinking that he had kind of missed the tone of the show utterly. And rereading it again, maybe about 3 years ago, I kind of moderated that particular take on it, but it still drove me a tiny bit nuts as adaptations go. Just because, I mean, I was thinking about, you know, I mean, Grant Morrison wrote stuff about The Prisoner, and there's been so much, you know, oddball fanfic and stuff like that that's come out, and. Mm-hmm. I think I went into it expecting a lot more than I actually got out of it. But that's just me. So. Is there anything else on the dish front we need to discuss? Did I forget any books?
Well, there's plenty of books.
Yeah.
That's the other thing, like I said, I think people may not even realize the breadth of his bibliography.
Yep.
He wrote tons of short stories, and actually that's one area of Dish that I'm not well versed in. I've only read literally like two or three of his stories, and I've got collections that are just I need to get into. But there's a lot. I mean, there's so much you could talk about, I think, with Dish, that, you know, one of the things I had actually talked about with a couple people was maybe proposing to University of Illinois' Masters of SF series doing a Dish book. But
do you think, John,
if that would fly?
Do you think that there's anybody currently publishing whose sort of doing callbacks to his quote unquote classic stuff, his 70s stuff. Is there anyone who's sort of tapping that vein right now?
Oh boy. I don't know. I mean, like, no one immediately leaps to mind, certainly.
Yeah. Me neither. That's why I was kind of curious if you could think of anyone.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny you think it, because I was thinking a little bit about that earlier today, and trying to think, you know, he's connected very strongly with the new wave, and then in the 80s kind of doesn't get sort of picked up and brought along a way that a lot of other writers did. I'm trying to think, you know, who was doing that kind of stuff that Dish was doing, and I mean, you can certainly argue that a lot of the better written dystopias have some resonance with what he was doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the ones that actually try to imbue some sense of lived experience into the dystopia, not just making this sort of classic dystopia that oppresses everybody and everyone's a piece of,
right,
you know, clockwork inside the machine. But no one immediately comes to mind who's really doing what Dish was doing.
I just caught a glimpse of the spine on my bookshelf of Burning Paradise by Robert Charles Wilson, and I'm going, oh, that kind of plays with the you know, having agency in a world you can't control type of thing, but it certainly does not match it for tone or for character depth.
No, well, that's, I mean, the unique thing about Dish was how he just combined irony and satire and that sense of, you know, of a sense of real people, of like complex characters with both agency and suffering under great constraints. Like I said, but also with that little the definite irony, but also with sometimes an edge of humor or satire to it. And I don't know anybody immediately that comes to mind who's doing anything like that right now.
I am in search of this now. Ha, ha, ha. Neat. Very neat. Yes. Well,
my final thought on Dish was that, I mean, I may have not liked what I read, but I'm happy to have read outside my comfort zone.
Good.
Perhaps a theme we will return to later.
Yeah. Do we want to talk about culture consumed, or Fred, I think you had a topic you wanted to talk about for a bit.
Well, we can conclude with that one.
Okay. All right.
Culture. Sure.
Let's do culture consumed. And Fred, why don't we go with you first?
All right. Well, I will make an announcement in general. I am, longtime fans of this podcast may recall, I went to HonorCon in 2013 and again in 2014. And I was just asked this past week to join the organization called BU9, or Bureau 9, which is sort of an advisory board to David Weber to try and keep this increasingly complex universe that he's developing straight and consistent and working within the framework he has set out. So I will be helping out with what they call social media.
Oh, you're going to be drunk with power, aren't you?
Yeah, right. No, I don't think so. there's too many people in there with more power than I do that will keep me on the straight and narrow. No, basically what I'll be working on is helping to spread the word. I mean, there's going to be a movie coming, we hope, sometime. There's a game on the handhelds, and there's a game on the board, and there's all sorts of other things. So just trying to get the word out.
Awesome.
So it's kind of a, I'll be interested to see what I think of this in a year. otherwise, I am at 17 books for the year and 172 short works. Some of the things I read, I reread again The Age of Ultron by The Age of Ultron by Brian Michael Bendis, this time the quote-unquote complete event. And I was, again, pretty frustrated as I was last year when I read it. Because I'm like, okay, you really don't resolve this. It doesn't end. And did you kill the guy, or is he coming back? Is Earth rebooted? What's going on? So,
oh, God,
I'm just, you know, I don't know. We'll see what the movie. Hopefully, the movie's better.
I'll talk about that when I get to my stuff. So
okay. What else did I read? I read. I'll save the fiction for a bit. I finished a book I had started last year, Conversations with William Gibson, edited by Patrick A. Smith, and that was another frustrating read, mostly because I may be reading all these interviews. I mean, what the guy does is he collects, let's say, 20-some-odd interviews with William Gibson over the years from the 80s until very recently. And the problem is either because I read them all back-to-back, pretty much, or the way they're arranged, which is chronologically, by the time you get to the third conversation with William Gibson about pattern recognition, you're like, yeah, okay. you know, there are some excellent interviews in there, but for the most part, everyone always hits the same notes, which, you know, if you look at it, if you read this book, you can see why some authors hate doing a tour or doing serial interviews, because how many times can you talk about how you invented cyberspace?
Hmm.
Or how Case, you know, has this thing about brands or whatever. I mean, there are other things you can ask the guy, but so. I bought it in hardcover, and it eventually came out in ebook, and I bought it again. I wish I had just bought it in ebook, because I'm probably going to give up the hardcover. That's just wasn't worth keeping, I don't think, on the shelf. Before we get to the last thing I want to talk about in terms of what I read, I did get through a lot more of Howard Taylor's Schlock Mercenary. I read The Scrapyard of Insufferable Arrogance, Resident Mad Scientist, Emperor Pius Day, The Sharp End of the Stick, and The Body Politic. And, I mean, I probably go through the whole series every couple of years when he comes out with a new volume, starting from scratch again, and I always enjoy his stuff. And the last book I read, or most recent book I read, was, and you guys are going to have to help me with the pronunciation on the first name again, Xian Liu, is it?
I believe so.
Okay, The Three-Body Problem, which is the first part of a trilogy translated by Ken Liu. I don't know. Did anybody else read that yet or
yes,
not?
Yes, I did.
Okay. I enjoyed it. It has some, I mean, I love some of the characters. There's a policeman in there that was a scream. He was just such a hilarious guy. And I have some problems with the alien race as depicted right now, but I thought it was great to see a science fictional view from China, you know, in a historical view as well. And there were some really neat things in there, like basically a computer made out of people.
Mm-hmm.
And some really great characters, not only the policeman, but the main character I thought was interesting. And then there's a Chinese general that I thought was a lot of fun too. So I am eagerly awaiting the next installment and the third installment as well when they come out. And the only other culture consumed I'll mention is that at this point, my daughter, I believe, has probably read more comics than I have. She's went through Deadpool. She went through Ms. Marvel, two runs of Captain Marvel. She's reading The Avengers. She's reading Uncanny X-Men. She's reading, she asked me to get her Mockingbird.
Mockingbird, yeah.
Yeah, Mockingbird, because she saw that on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Not sure what else she's read, but she's definitely, every weekend, that's all she seems to be doing is reading my digital comics. So she's way ahead of where I am. So that is my culture consumed.
Nice.
Nice.
John, what about you?
Yes, my paltry offerings. Actually, it's a funny thing. When I'm ill, I don't read a lot because it's too much effort. Like, I start reading and just can't do it. So, but I did manage to do some reading. I finished Ursula Le Guin's Finding My Elegy, her poetry collection.
Ooh.
It was okay. It was all right. There were a couple of poems that were really good. But I was trying to put, like, I was about two-thirds of the way through, and I was trying to put my finger on why I couldn't read more than two or three poems, and I just want to put it down. I was like, And there's just something that seems too mannered and just not evocative enough. And even when I like the point of the poem or I like the theme, it just didn't seem to build satisfyingly within the poem to really make me feel, you know, engaged and affected. So there were three or four really good poems, and then the rest were just kind of okay, which was kind of surprising, but I hadn't read much for poetry before, so this was a new experience for me. I also read Robin Hobb's The Inheritance and Other Stories, her Robin Hobb / Megan Lynn Holm collection. And that was good. It wasn't great. There were a few stories that felt very pat, very much more about the SFNL expectations than about the emotional heft in the story. But overall, I thought it was a good collection. I felt that means she's a very good writer. She can be very straightforward in her descriptions and create what seems like a very almost by the numbers presentation of character, but then something surprising will happen. And those surprises are what you kind of wait for and kind of relish when they occur. And there was a lot of that in there, which I appreciated. And, I read, the first volume, the first collected graphic novel volume of Red Sonja, The Queen of Plagues, written by Gail Simone, which was pretty good too. The art could have been better, I think, overall. But I liked that she understood that there's a weird combination of exaggeration and a strange kind of power in what Red Sonja represents. And she brought that out in the story itself. So there's this juxtaposition of sort of Red Sonja, sort of a legend versus Red Sonja as a person.
Yeah.
Who at the same time is an extraordinary person. And I thought she did a very good job with that. So I think she has a good grasp of what to do with the character. So I'm looking forward to reading the next volume when it comes out. And then most of the rest of my reading was Dish. I read Dark Verses and Light, the poetry collection. I reread 334. I reread Particamp Concentration. And I started reading the early science fiction stories of Thomas Dish volume. But I only got a couple of stories in, so I'm still working through that. It's an interesting experience because, like I think I said earlier, I haven't read a lot of his short stories. So it's interesting to see what he does with the short form and how he tries to pack a lot of punch into the shorter format. And that was what I read this in the last several weeks. And then my one sort of genre viewing was I saw the Black Mirror series from the UK.
Yeah.
Which Netflix had three episodes from the first season, three episodes from the second season.
It's all there is. Yeah.
Is that all there is?
It's all there is, yeah. And the Christmas special that came out a couple months ago.
Okay, I haven't seen that yet. But the first season I thought was fantastic. I thought they did a very good job of taking the sort of core SF idea and making it really interesting to see see people deal with the implications of it. I thought the second season was not very good. I thought they went to some story ideas that were very, very cliche and very trite. And I thought the acting was good. I thought the actors were doing the best of the material they could. But the stories just didn't have the same interesting twists and the same emotional heft that I thought the first season did.
I would agree with you there. I did However, I will say that I recommend the episode White Bear to people because it's still one of those things that I haven't made up my mind about. You can argue for and against the denouement of that particular story episode, forever if you wanted to. Yeah, the first season.
The twist that comes about, it's like bad. It just felt like bad Twilight Zone to me.
I would agree with you, and it kind of let me down when it happened. But then he just kept hammering home the implications of that twist for the rest of it.
Right.
Like saying, yeah, this is a cliche. Yeah, well, what about this? What about this? What about this? And he just kept throwing stuff at you the whole time. And I was like, oh, my Lord, that's brutal. I would recommend finding the Christmas episode of Black Mirror's White Christmas. It's one long story that contains several smaller stories.
Okay.
And I thought it was really good. I like the way it was done.
Nice.
I love the second episode. What's it called? 10 million credits or 100,000 credits?
15 million credits.
15 million credits, yeah. That I really liked that because it was the first time that I had seen somebody take a full-blown reality TV, social media type of thing and show that as a fairly traditional dystopia.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was done really well. I thought that the number of little things that were inserted into it were, were really nice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So cool. Very good. Well, I was about 2/3 of the way through Galaxy Game when we last spoke in January, and I finished it, and I enjoyed the book. However, my enjoyment of the book is a little problematic for a number of reasons. Number one, I, in general, in very broad strokes, do not like science fiction stories about children. I, in very broad strokes, do not like science fiction stories about telepaths as a class. And I really don't like stories about games. And this book was about all three, and yet I still enjoyed it. So the deeper I got into the story, the more I really did not want to like it, but I did enjoy it quite a bit. So that kind of put me on a trajectory to start thinking about various ways a lot of the tropes and themes in that had been approached. And I kind of went a little old school. Right after I read that, I read Stephen Arsenault's The Omega Exile, which is the first of, I think, two books that have come out so far in the Omega series, which is about a post-human future, but I don't mean a transhumanist future. I mean a future after humans have been in power. And it's pretty good. I want to read the second book before I make my full-blown judgment on it. But characters are really done. POV characters, fantastic. A lot of the way the technology is brought up. A lot of really funny, fun naming conventions that are applied. It kept me going. At no point was I bored and want to put it down, but I do want to read the other book in the series just to see how he's going to play that out. And speaking of series, I decided to go a little bit old school after that when I came to the space opera genre, and I reread the Soothsayer trilogy by Mike Resnick, which takes place in the same universe as Santiago and Dark Lady. Soothsayer, Prophet, and Oracle are the three books. And very similar to Santiago, it's a story that's told from the point of view of several interesting characters in this particular future that he has built. And, everybody's always scrambling for the next property to convert into a long-term TV show. Well, the Santiago universe in general would be ideal for that because it's not a single narrative thread that's running through. He's basically handing you a lot of really neat characters that you can do whatever you want with at that point. But I had not read the Soothsayer book since they had come out, and I really enjoyed it. I always, I don't want to say I forget how much I enjoyed the Santiago books, but that the depth of that particular universe that he's built always always surprises me. I mean, between Santiago and the Dark Lady and Penelope Bailey and the Iceman and the Whistler and all the other, there are no normal characters in that universe. They're all eccentric in one way or another. And speaking of eccentric characters, I read for the first time ever There and Back Again by Pat Murphy, which is a strange little space opera retelling of The Hobbit.
Of the Hobbit, yep.
And I had never read it. I found it at a bookstore a few weeks ago and sort of tore through that with the various clones of the very rich family and the sort of somewhat episodic adventures that sort of pile on top of each other as the character is basically just trying to get home. A lot of fun. Between that and the Resnick, it sort of dawned on me that I'm not reading that many really fun space operas. No one's doing space opera as a romp anymore. Just kind of struck me that it was done that way. And in the totally opposite direction, to bring my point home, I reread Well of Stars by Robert Reed, which is by no means a romp. Everything is always very high stakes throughout the course of the entire story. And that is such a utterly dramatic book when it comes to each section widening the scope of the threat that they're up against as the great ship makes its way towards this particularly odd nebula. Really, it makes me really want to go back and reread all of the great ship books in order, which always annoys me when I read a book that makes me want to do that, because I know it's going to be several weeks of my time to do that. So, and the other thing I read, which I had never read before, was Raising the Stones by Sherry Tepper, which I don't think I finished it. I think I've still got about 40 pages of that I have to get through, which is really good. Story about a culture that's being observed by this sort of galactic authority. I had not really dipped my toes into Sherry Tepper in a while, so it was kind of fun to be reminded, you know, how much I enjoy her books. Comic book wise, one thing I have not talked about yet, as the series Fables is getting ready to wrap up, there has been a digital spin-off story that's been coming out on a weekly basis for the last 12 weeks or so called Fable Wolf Among Us. It's written by Michael Sturgis. And it's basically a... Matthew Sturgis. It's a story about there's been a murder near Fable Town, and Bigby Wolf has to go find out who did it. And over the course of going through this mystery and running into oddball characters like Tweedledee and Tweedledum, etc., we find out a lot of the back history between Bigby Wolf and the Woodsman from Little Red Riding Hood. There are several retellings of Little Red Riding Hood over the course of this particular series so far. The one criticism I do have about it is that certain episodes do tend to come to a full stop in order to tell some of the backstory. It seems like it's patterned in a way sort of the way Watchmen was when it got back to telling origin stories, but in the case of Alan Moore, he actually managed to add information to both the characters and the plot, where in this it literally is a full stop, tell the backstory, then pick up with the action. Fortunately, they're all brief, and the momentum of the story is pretty good, but I'm not certain how many episodes of that are going to be out. They're up to 12 right now. But I like reading when DC does their comics for digital. It's nice because they're oriented horizontally, so they take up the whole screen, and I sort of like that particular method of storytelling. Marvel's been putting out a S.H.I.E.L.D. comic lately, which is basically entrenched Agent Coulson in the DC universe. There have been three issues out so far, and he's got several members of the team from the TV show with him. What's interesting about the book is that it's almost global frequency. Coulson will draft somebody into service to deal with a particular issue. In the last issue, he grabbed Spider-Man solely because Spider-Man knows the layout of the inside of Doctor Strange's house, and somebody has broken into Doctor Strange's house and done something awful, which will spell the end of the world if not stopped. Ms. Marvel was in the second issue, which had to do with it was something that some threat that's taking place in a high school that she goes to, and it was pretty fun. The book itself is very, very fun. Coulson is exactly the Coulson you expect him to be, and seeing him interact, not just interact with characters in the Marvel Universe, but A, get the respect for being an effective S.H.I.E.L.D. agent, and B, everybody realizing that he's kind of a smart ass. I'm actually waiting for the Coulson Hawkeye crossover to happen at some point just to see how that plays out. But I've been enjoying that. Fred Van Lente's been writing a book called Ivar Timewalker. The second issue has come out. It's sort of Doctor Who meets the Terminator. A time traveler grabs this woman from the present and says, "You have to come with me because somebody from the future is trying to kill you." And from there, it becomes a time travel romp. And who the person is who's trying to kill her is revealed. And it's a fun use of a time travel trope in a comic. And the way it's represented visually is also really neat. The other book that's really blown me away, I think they're up to four issues right now. It's written by Donnie Cates. The art is by Daniel Warren Johnson. And the book is called Ghost Fleet. And it has to do with a secret society which has employed the services of a yet another secret society that runs a fleet of trucks cross country to transport something. We still don't know what it is yet, but we know it's very powerful and very bad if it gets out, sort of like the briefcase in Pulp Fiction. And a guy with a grudge against the secret society. And so far it's been really good. I'm curious as to where it's going because every issue so far has thrown a surprise plot wise at me. Also wanted to mention the 12th Doctor series Doctor Who book that Robbie Morrison is doing with Dave Taylor just wrapped up its second storyline called The Sword of Kali, and it was really good. It sort of grabbed it was the closest thing to almost a classic Tom Baker story that they've done in the comic so far, where you're taking an established culture with an established mythology and science fictionalizing it. With a capital S and a capital F, really goes a three-part story, a lot of fun. I'm really liking where he's taking the 12th Doctor right now. I think it's the best of the Doctor Who books that are currently coming out. I wanted to talk about Avengers and New Avengers real quick too, which has been dealing for the last, 2 years now with the various multiversal incursions that were sort of triggered by the end of Age of Ultron that you mentioned, Fred.
Okay.
At the end of Age of Ultron, there were a few stories in both the Marvel Universe and the Ultimate Universe that sort of played with the breaking of time that sort of occurred at the end of that. Well, that's been ramping up, and the Marvel characters who call themselves the Illuminati, who are always the smartest guys in the room, started seeing evidence that the situation was getting worse. And over the last 6 months, we've been seeing the books sort of leap into the future a little bit as things become dire. And we know this is all going to be leading up to the new Secret Wars, which is happening at the end of the spring into the summer. The story itself about all these really smart, uber competent guys who were all damaged in one way or another, dealing with a threat of this magnitude and the alienness of the threat, is really, really good. I really wish that this was not an Avengers story. If somebody wrote a science fiction comic with this level of depth and multiple world building and throwing really deadly rules at you, I would be cheering like crazy. The problem is, as an Avengers story, and the fact that I don't want to say it's decompressed because it's not, it's very dense, but it's basically issue after issue of people sitting around explaining how bad things are. And that's not necessarily bad in a good science fiction story, but this is the Avengers we're talking about, and we should be seeing a little bit more out of this. I remember John's criticism about the Apocalypse Twins, that whole story that happened a while back, and I'm sort of feeling the same thing he did in that, which is, you know, let's okay, we get it, things are bad, let's move on, please. Obviously, they're going to milk this right up to Secret Wars, and I'll reserve judgment to them. But it's just one of those utterly frustrating things where you go, you know what, this is actually a really good science fiction story. It just makes for a lousy superhero comic. And I do not encounter that often. So when I do, it becomes irritating. Two things fall into the negative, both that have books that I've mentioned in the past. Odyssey, ODY-C, by Matt Fraction with the art by Christian Ward, which is the gender-swapped retelling of the Odyssey. We're three issues into it, and I think three, maybe four, and it's just a mess. It really is. It's just a mess. He's dug a hole here that I really hope he can pull out of. I'm really rooting for him, but it's there's a lot of eye rolling on my end on it. And the other book that's sort of in the similar pit right now for me is Grant Morrison's Annihilator. It started off as a really good reality affecting fiction and vice versa. It was a neat little science fiction tale that he was building. I thought one of the characters was way too whiny, but I think he was kind of doing that on purpose to show how whiny Hollywood people are. And it was moving along really, really nicely. In the last couple of issues, it's just sort of become, how many neat things can I throw at you without moving the plot forward? So, I'll read it through to the end, but I think we're in second act blues for both of these books right now, and they need to pick up. They need to pick up their game a little bit. So that's about everything. Just let me check. Yeah. Oh, and I just started Best of Clark's World Volume 6 too, which because most of the stories in there I have not read yet, and it still stuns me the good selection of work that they get in that publication. So. So that is my culture consumed. I actually managed to read a lot. Most of that is short, very short, except for the Well of Stars by Robert Reed. I think that's the only thing over 300 pages in my whole pile there. I've been sticking with the smaller stuff. Unlike John, I can actually read when I'm sick, but it has to be short. So if the spine is more than 3/4 inch wide, I set it aside and grab something else. Strangely enough, Well of Stars I grabbed on my way to a series of medical things and read most of it in the waiting room. So take away from that what you will. So, okay, Fred.
Jeff.
I think you had an issue you wanted to discuss.
Yes, I did.
All right. The floor is yours.
I'm sure we will all discuss this. recently there was a essay posted which talked about Star Trek and how we all were attracted to Star Trek because of the whooshing noises of the doors and the engines and the hard science fiction. And recently there was an essay posted about how we should read outside our comfort zone. And the reaction to both was kind of interesting. I mean, for me, Star Trek was as much hard science fiction as it was soft science fiction. The author of the essay complains about how science fiction, I guess, is being emasculated, becoming soft, becoming too concerned with the lighter end of things rather than the photons and the electrons. But if you look at Star Trek, you had, as we discussed at the beginning of the episode today, Spock was the other. I mean, you had a black woman on the bridge. You had Asians. You had Russians during the height of the Cold War. You had interracial kisses. I mean, even as silly an episode as Let That Be Your Last Battlefield, you discuss race issues in a way that you really didn't find in a lot of other places. So, you know, to think that Star Trek is only about the whooshing of the doors kind of ignores a lot of what Star Trek is about. And the same thing goes with this reaction that I've seen over the essay about, you know, reading outside your comfort zone. I mean, science fiction is about reading outside your comfort zone. It has been for decades. Whether it's science, because you're not into science, or aliens or others. And come on, folks, women have been writing science fiction for a long time, longer than most of the people that have been complaining about this have been alive, and have produced some pretty damn good stories. It's, you know, the let's face it, the doors are open. Instead of wishing to go back to the good old days, let's move forward. The only way we're going to continue to grow as a field is if we invite more and more people in and write new stuff. We just can't keep reading Edgar Rice Burroughs. As much as I still love Edgar Rice Burroughs, you just can't keep reading Edgar Rice Burroughs over and over again.
Well, maybe so. if the John Carter books had whooshing doors, we'd read a little more of it. You know.
Well, you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, your point about hard SF, we were talking before we went on the air, and I remember that first Star Trek Expo that I went to in New York City, and how when I was in the dealer's room, I saw the fans who were grabbing the technical manuals and the blueprints and who were going through the different models and showing off their models with fiber optics in them and stuff like that. And there definitely was a technical fan base to the show, primarily because I think so much of a technical overview was placed on the show. The fact that the show had so many, you know, technical staff that made sure looks and technologies were consistent, et cetera. But at the same time, there were the people who were, you know, buying up the large volumes of fanfic, and there were the people that were writing about, you know, sociology in Trek and who were discussing the various, you know, forms of alienness. And Spock was not popular because he was a neat alien. He was popular because he was an outsider. And he was not only an outsider, but he was a crossbreed outsider, so he was doubly an outsider, and who threw himself into his work. And he by no means was on par behaviorally with someone like Lieutenant Barclay, but he was certainly fulfilling a lot of the same role. He was somebody who was incapable of feeling comfort by virtue of his, you know, Vulcan heritage, and incapable of feeling emotion or trying to keep his emotions in check. But the fact that he had to look at everything else from an outside point of view, and even though he established friendships over the course of the franchise, and even though he garnered so much respect over the course of the franchise, you see a lot of, Balance of Terror, the fact that there's actual racism against Spock over the course of that episode and stuff like that. It certainly was not, you know, and that's the most technical battle-filled episode of the show that you can imagine. That's the closest thing to it being a military SF show, and it turns out to be about racism and perceptions, and to basically pin it down as only a one-sided thing is ludicrous. Because there's been so many sides to it. So many, I mean, look at all the various directions that the Trek fandom has gone in over the years. The people who are meticulous about their uniforms as opposed to the people who have gone on to, you know, build the expanded universe. You know, I've been reading, you know, Keith DeCandido's rewatches on tor.com of Deep Space Nine, and as of next week, he's going to go back and start doing the original series, and I'm really looking forward to it, because as much as I like the original rewatches they did, DeCandido actually says, here's where this episode stands in the greater Star Trek canon of the novels and the comics, etc., and he's done a really good job with that, and he shows off both the technical, military, and the sociological impacts that each episode actually had, so... I agree with you wholeheartedly on that one.
Exactly.
As for reading outside the comfort zone, I mean, that's something that I did a lot, and I've mentioned it quite a bit, both because of you guys and from the people that I've podcasted with on SF Signal. And it's had a distinct impact on me. I mean, there are books that I read that I go, yeah, this book does not blow me away, but I still read it, and I look at the craft, and I look at the workmanship, and I look at the themes that people are undertaking, and I go, wow, this is stuff I really had not considered before. Mm-hmm. One book that I did not mention that I did read right after we talked was Elysium by Jen Bissett, and I met her at World Fantasy, and Jamie Todd Rubin introduced us, and her book came out, and I read that, and it's already up for, is it the Dick Award it's up for, I think? And I mean, that's a book that's wholly unlike anything else that I've read. Just in its approach, and in the way that approach plays out over the course of the novel. And it's a very short novel, but I can easily see why it was nominated, because it is a very, very fresh approach. But if somebody had explained the book to me before I read it, I might have said, that's not really in my comfort zone. I'm not going to do it. It turned out to be a wonderful book. And I felt the same way when we were talking to David Annandale about horror. It was something I took away from that conversation, was the changes that took place in horror and the changes that took place in dark fantasy also had an impact on me when it came to looking at what could be done with the talent that's out there. And as the discussion went on, and as more and more books that I was reading were from parts of the publishing landscape that I really hadn't touched before, that really rang true. That, you know, there's a lot of changes, and it is certainly a big enough tent. Anybody who argues otherwise, that there is a single unifying vision when it comes to what SF is, you know, I've mentioned before, the consensus future went out the door in the early 80s, you know, and primarily because the world disagreed with it, let alone the science fiction that came after. So That's my take on it. I mean, I agree with you utterly, and there are better uses of, I'll add to that, that there are better uses of fandom's time, you know, like reading, than to give the arguments that you bring up as much traction, column inches, brain space, whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, This malarkey that keeps going on with attacking people, outing people, doxing people. Folks, this is just... Stop being dicks, seriously. Stop being dicks.
Really? Whedon's Law, come on, people. It's not that difficult.
Behave towards those online as you would if you were talking to them in person. And if you can't behave that way in person, then I really don't want to have anything to do with you.
I've always said that.
Yeah. The vitriol is what really struck me in both conversations.
Yeah.
Just the excessive anxiety ridden responses, particularly to the reading challenge. I mean, I read the piece you were talking about, which is, I think, called Destroy the Myth, Destroy the Culture, and which basically says there's only one way to look at Star Trek in a productive way. If you look at it some other way, it's destructive. Mm-hmm. That's really what he's saying. And that's just so ridiculous that I don't even know how to respond to them and say that's just stupid. And also, your sociology is bad. Go read a dictionary about what sociology actually is, dude.
What frustrates me the most, and one of the reasons I really stopped paying to attention a lot of this stuff after a couple paragraphs is, I just sit there and I go, this is the point you're trying to make. This is the argument that you're going to. I remember having an hour and a half long argument with somebody about the fact that the Discovery engines make noise in the movie 2010. All right. Hour and a half. That's sad. I realize it's sad. Okay. And it meant something to me. And I realized that a lot of these points mean something to other people, but you can't change minds through insults.
No,
it's right. Never worked ever.
Right. Well, I think it's not about changing minds is the problem. In both cases, the responses are not about changing minds. They're about saying the choice that I made is the right and only one, and I'm going to defend that to the discursive death, pretty much. I mean, the thing about the reading challenge was interesting to me, especially given our topic tonight, where Tom Dish is the author who taught me to read outside my comfort zone.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I was reading mostly, you know, Heinlein juveniles and adventure fiction, and almost exclusively by, you know, white male authors. It's pretty much it. But reading Dish is the author who taught me that it's rewarding to read stuff that doesn't make you comfortable, to look for stuff that doesn't make you comfortable, to look for stuff that you go, would I like that? Should I try it? What is that? To keep and to make reading an active pursuit, not to make reading a passive, I take whatever rolls my way kind of attitude towards it. But the, you know, part of reading is going out and looking for new stories, looking for new ideas and new perspectives. It's not just reading the book, it's finding the books and understanding how the books get produced and understanding that there's so much out there. And there's so much great stuff out there that doesn't fit into, you know, comfortable preconceptions. And that's what we should be doing with reading, is looking for that stuff.
There was a... John Byrne did a comic, I want to say 2 years ago, and I believe it was called The Highways or The High Roads. Yeah, The Highways is what it was called. And it was a guy gets hired on a space freighter. They go out to Jupiter space. They discover there's a weird project going on near Jupiter. Or maybe it was Saturn. I forget. And things go horribly wrong, as occur in stories of that nature. And he drew this thing very, very hardware heavy and very... You know, everything looked lived in. Everything looked outland. You know, it was all, very, very meticulous and very, very analog as well. And a lot of people were saying, oh, this is neat. John Byrne is doing retrofuturism. And his response was, no, I'm doing futurism. And I was like, that's interesting that there is that the book is being perceived as something that he's. That is not the intention of the author, because he's sort of picking up a lot of threads from that consensus future that I talked about and doing what we would consider a classic, very hardware wishing door science fiction story. But mm-hmm. Everybody else, a lot of people who read it said, oh, look, what a quaint little revisiting of of ages past when stories like this got told. And, I see a very similar thread, you know, what you just mentioned about him not trying to change minds. I see a very similar thread when I see these arguments play out online of readers vehemently imbuing their favorite stories with their own meaning, and usually for their own purposes.
Mm-hmm.
And author's intent tends to go out the door. I certainly think that the reading challenge could benefit from reading lists, perhaps split up by things like subgenre and tone and stuff like that, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, the number of books that I've picked up in the last few years that I've picked up expecting to be a far future space opera, and it turns out they're not by any stretch of the imagination, has kind of shocked me. The fact that I'll get, you know, 100 pages into a book and go, God damn it, we're doing this again, has been there. I think it could certainly benefit from support materials, for lack of anything else. And if there are some out there, I am not aware of them. But yes, I agree with you wholeheartedly, Fred.
Well, glad I'm not the only one.
Okay.
I mean, I look at my walls and, man, you know, if I hadn't read Delaney, if I hadn't read, you know, who knows what that wouldn't have led to. Maybe I wouldn't have read Pole. You ignore stuff and you don't know what you miss. Mm. And you're poorer for it. Mm-hmm.
Oh, I hear that. And I think we've certainly, I mean, I don't think any of this should come as a surprise, given the topics that we talked about on this podcast over the coming up on 2 years now that we've been doing it. So, and that's as good a time as any to remind people that, yes, we are eligible for Hugo nomination if they are
so inclined.
If they are so inclined. Listening to a bunch of old white guys babble is always fun and enjoyable. We try to,
yes.
We know we have at least one fan out there, so
maybe two.
Yeah, we have a lot of listeners, but fans are hard to come by, you know. So
if we're not our own fans, then we're really in trouble.
Awesome. Well, gentlemen, I think that's as good a spot as any.
I agree.
To wrap this one up. So we will hopefully do another episode later in the month of March. I hope wherever you are, the weather is improving, although I highly doubt it by the time this gets posted. We should be seeing above freezing temperatures by the end of the week here in Virginia, but I'm not holding my breath because every time they've said that the last 2 weeks, it's been a bait and switch. Weather Channel is a scam, man. We need to discuss the naming of winter storms at some point, too, because this is starting to get ridiculous. So all right. Excellent discussion, gentlemen.
All right. Thank you.
Until next time.
Yep.
Have a good night.
Have a good night.
Right.